All right, everybody, we're going to get started. Welcome to transforming a global Fortune 100 company with IT service management using System Center, Office 365, and Microsoft Business Intelligence. My name is Nathan Lesniowski, and what I'm going to be walking you through today is a practical example of how you can go about reimagining IT in an IT organization. We're going to show you both process and technology. So we're going to be walking through both how we change the overall process of an organization and then how that process mapped to the overall technology picture that an organization was using. Who here in the audience was in the ITIL for IT Pros session? OK, a portion of you. You can kind of think about this as almost like a part two, right? So if we take a lot of those patterns and practices and we bring those into an organization and we implement those patterns and practices, you're going to see that this has a very significant impact in the way that they're talking to their customers, interacting with their customers, and executing on IT services. We're going to show you this implementation within the context of Microsoft tools. So all these different elements we're going to be displaying are going to be either in Office 365, or in Power View or Power BI, or inside of System Center. All right. What you can use as sort of framework coming into this week and leaving this week is that Microsoft is re-engaging in different types of IT spaces. One of those IT spaces that you've probably heard a lot about is the service provider. The service provider space is, I'm an organization that delivers a technology that people consume from me. Maybe it's a virtual machine like Azure's delivering, or it's an application that people consume from you. So maybe your business essentially exists to deliver the ability for people to book travel flights online. Your main deliverable as a business is a technology service. That's really what a service provider is all about. It's about taking technology and delivering that for consumption from someone outside an organization. And Microsoft's really interested in serving that market. Another market is enterprises functioning as service providers. So if I'm an enterprise and I'm very interested in people consuming services from me, and I want my end users to see that I'm serving their needs, what you're seeing is that enterprises are transitioning from being these sort of black boxes where money goes in and complaints come out to being service providers that describe the things that they're offering to the business, and then the business consumes those services from them in a way which allows them to almost go out like they're shopping for that service. That's what they're seeing that they're getting from the public cloud. And this story is about an enterprise going about functioning like a public cloud provider. The third market is the consumer market. That's your Joe end user who's got a tablet at home who you're going to go and interact with, kind of a bring your own device sort of scenario. We're not going to be focusing as much on that scenario in this conversation. This is going to be mostly about enterprises functioning as service providers. One concept that I want to get across, and if you leave this session with only one concept, is the concept of an IT service. An IT service is something that we deliver to the business. It's a thing that people consume from you. If you're Amazon.com, it's the ability to buy a shoe online or the ability to go about ordering some groceries and having them shipped to your home. If you're an enterprise, it's things like personal computing services or communication services, or customer ordering services. It describes what you do, what you deliver to the business. So what we focused on in this customer example is the idea that we deliver a service to the business, and then we're responsible for managing its quality and its consistency, as well as performing continuous service improvement against that specific service, and then proving it. So we're going to map each of these to individual technologies. So the customer that we're going to be talking about today is Johnson Controls. And I'm going to introduce Clark Bobert, who's going to be walking through a little bit about their story.
Thanks, Nate. So as you can see, we are a very sizable company. Obviously, as you see up here, we're in the Fortune 100. Kind of our footprint, it gives you a pretty good idea of our footprint, our IT staff, and kind of what we had to transform kind of from a technology perspective to a service perspective. So where do you start? So it really started for us when we were looking at upgrading our entire PC fleet from XP to Windows 7 and really getting that standardized throughout our entire organization. So what we did was is we leveraged Service Manager to do that for us. So as you can see, we started with our PC deployment and our application deployment. And you can see some of the numbers that we've run through the system already, very sizable numbers. We also put all of our asset management for our PCs and servers into Service Manager. With the success we had there, we got the approval to move forward for full IT service management. So our desire is to transform, like I said, a technology organization into a service organization. And Nate's going to kind of walk you through how we set forth on that objective.
All right, so when we started down this path, one of the things that we wanted to do is articulate the core goals of the project. Because if we weren't mapping toward outcomes, we weren't really able to prove that we showed a success. So I'll walk you through what those outcomes that we planned are. The first is fix the process. One of the original conversations I came up was, well, this is just a remedy replacement. You're just replacing this existing tool that we're running that's nearing end of life with a new tool that should be doing the same thing. The problem is that if we took that approach, we just end up with the same broken process that got us there. So the first objective that we had in this project was to adopt clean, proven practices by using a directed design to refactor how we go about delivering IT. And I'll show you some examples of how we did that. We focused on services. So prior to this, we were very focused on delivering a computer, delivering email, these very or pragmatic, basic things that our end users barely understood, and we name them based on technologies. We've changed to orienting this around services instead. So I'll show you an example of how that's mapped into our service catalog. We found Access Anywhere to be really important to us. So the idea is that people don't always sit from their normal desktop anymore, right? They're not just coming into the office, sitting down, doing work, and then leaving. They need access to this from Surface devices, from iPads, from your phone devices, they need access to it from someone else's desktop. They need to be able to have a variety of ways to get into the system. So Access Anywhere was a core tenet to how we went about accomplishing this project. Visibility. Visibility was about presenting data from our captured historical information. So as tickets flow through the system, we want to represent those tickets within the context of incidents and service requests and change inside of business intelligence tools like PowerView. We focused a lot on configuration management. One of the big benefits that we received from this project was taking all the data that we're getting from SCCM, mapping that into Service Manager, and then allowing us to perform self-service requests against it. That same configuration data is leveraged for the asset itself and its relationship to the work items that come in as incidents. We wanted to automate. When we convert people, we give them several different options. Automation is one of those. I think one of the greatest successes is that in our first part of this project, we had the opportunity to be able to use this for the workstation deployment of over, 70,000 systems? So in that process, we were able to have a substantial savings in the work cost associated with going and doing a PC deployment. So when you've got thousands of IT people out in the field, you're not going to teach them all how to use SCCM. You're going to give them a self-service interface where they can go out and they can perform their bare metal request from a simple, easy to learn, come on off the street and start using it kind of experience. We also wanted to better serve our customer. One of the things that we found is that we had three global service desks plus several business unit desks, and the customer service was really bad. So the customer service experience went through several routes to get to the right people. So part of refactoring the process is to get the incident, when it gets opened, to the fastest resolution possible, and also to provide them consistent experience with a customer advocate coming from the service desk. All right. So this is an example of our topology. I'll just kind of walk you through what this looks like here. Right. Underneath, on the bottom side here, what you see is kind of our infrastructure. Infrastructure is, on the left-hand side, you see System Center Configuration Manager. It's connected to cloud services if we choose to do that in the future. On the right-hand side, you see a lot of our data center and public cloud services, right? We're consolidating those inside of System Center Service Manager, which is our CMDB, and also represents where we store all of our work items, incident, change, service request, problem, and release. It also represents our interaction with the orchestrator layer. So you may have gone to some sessions this week on orchestrator or SMA. That represents that layer of our interaction. From the standpoint of our end user experience, we decided to make as web-based as possible. So you can see on the end user side, we're focusing on our Office 365 presence. Johnson Controls has one of the largest Office 365 implementations in the world. So what we're doing with this is we're sending our end users to an Office 365 experience that's consistent with the rest of the portal experience they use. So when you log into your computer in the morning, you open up Internet Explorer, you get this Office 365 experience. That Office 365 experience then shares information with our portal experience as well. We also are using PowerView and Power BI, I'll show a demo of this, for our IT directors and executives, as well as our analysts. And then on the console side, we're using Web Console for our analyst experience, as well as looking at Windows Azure Pack for some of our provisioning experiences that exist in the data center. We also choose to use an agile approach. An agile approach is a little bit different than waterfall. An agile approach facilitates small sprints in which we deliver functionality. So one of the things that we did consistently through this project is we had eight sprints. And as you go through each sprint, we did a large presentation around the progress on each individual sprint path. The value behind doing Agile is it allowed us to get feedback faster rather than waiting for a full system to be built and then get feedback. This allowed us to be able to get feedback as we went along, which provided a great way to make adjustments as users were experiencing the system. We actually found that as we went through it, we started with two-week sprints. Two-week sprints ended up being a little bit too small because we spent a lot of time prepping for the sprint conversations rather than actually working. So in prepping for the sprint conversations, this tended to remove some of our time we had to focus on development. So we extended it to a three-week sprint cycle, which gave us more of that time available. We also went through a significant process work. So as we started the project, we went through what's called a directed design engagement. And directed design's goal is to say, here's what we see as best practices in the market. We're not starting from scratch here. I mean, things like ITIL framework do exist that we can pull from. So let's start with things we know. Let's apply those things that we know to the teams and understand their usage. Go about adjusting how we're delivering these services against that directed design, get approval around functional specifications, and then go about defining that as an enterprise framework for ITSM. So when we got to rolling this out, we have an enterprise framework we've defined against which we can make certain decisions, but the governance of which is defined by a central team. All right. As we demo, you're going to see that the idea of the service lifecycle is factored into this. So the service lifecycle's goal is to start at strategy where you first thought of doing something. So if I say, man, it'd be really cool if I was able to deliver customer ordering services, what would that actually look like? That first idea of the service is where it starts going into architecture, and you start figuring out what it is that you want to deliver to the business. Then you go into design, transitioning into operations, where you actually run the service, and then improving the service over time when you get customer feedback. All right. So what Clark is going to do is Clark's going to walk through the service design package. The service design package is our first intake of a service into Service Manager through a SharePoint portal in their Office 365 environment.
So I think we're ready to switch.
Three.
Yep. All right, as you can see, this is actually a page in our O365 portal environment. And it's really the place we go to, in a sense, request a new service or, in a sense, change a service. So this is all new to us because we didn't have anything like this to really go and define all that and make sure we followed a workflow. So you can see here we've got our different, you know, we've tiered it to kind of organize our services so it's easier to kind of find them. It's not levels of service. It's just the tiering to make it easier to find things. So for instance, if you want to request or change a service, you would just go ahead and go in and start the request page. As you can see on the left-hand side, what we've got is we've got our whole workflow in here, which shows you basically how we take something from, in a sense, an idea or business strategy all the way through into operations. So we've got that out there to help all the service owners and service managers understand what they need to walk through as they go through this. And we've got it laid out in each of the sections. So the first thing you'll notice is we have, in a sense, a gating process. So as you walk through this, usually your first stage is you're going to get requirements, right? And there's a number of things that you want to do as part of that requirements phase. You want to kind of have that vision of who you think the service owner would be. So, we can type my name in. Searches in our directory. Yep, Clark's available. Or Clark's a valid user, so we put him in. The next thing you would do is have an IT service name. So you want to start envisioning what that service name is, right? So a very, very common one that I think everybody has is, say, smartphones, right? And then as you go through, you would start checking off the documents that you need in order to get through that requirements phase. Now, what we've done is we've actually built a knowledge base in O365 as well, so we can have all of our documents in a central repository. We've put security around them so we can determine, are these documents available to everybody, to IT only, maybe only to global infrastructure, certain groups in IT, things like that. As you can see, what we've done with our knowledge page is we've organized it the same way. So we start organizing our documentation, tagging our documentation so that we can start using it within our search capabilities, which Nate will show you a little bit later. The idea then is as you go through each one of these gating processes, you would then go for an approval. It is up to the service owner and service manager later on to make sure that all that documentation is out there and valid in order to move to the next gate. So if we had all of our documentation, everything complete, I would get an approval. Once I've got that approval, which we actually flow through service manager and orchestrator to do that approval, I would then be able to go into gate two. Gate two would really be our deeper validation and evaluation process within architecture. This is where we're actually looking at the products that can potentially do this, and deciding on the standards that we want to use or that we want to go forward with as we build out this service. Again, we go through the same gating process. In gate two, you know, we've got, in a sense, design documents that we're putting together. We're putting an actual description in here, as you can see. Obviously, you can change these to meet your needs, but this gives you a very good insight of what our needs are and what we felt was important. The other thing that you'll notice in here is something called, and it's maybe hard to read, but it says backfill requirements. So one of the things, you know, the issue that we're going to have is we have tons of services out there today that have not gone through this process. So what we're doing is we've defined a limited set or a condensed set of fields that are required for the backfill process. So the idea is to go out, identify all of our services, and get them in here. So that we have everything in that service catalog, and then we've got this full workflow for any new services or change services that come through the organization. Again, you can see as we get into gate three, what we do is we do, in a sense, a platform sign-off. So what we try to do is we try to get our architecture and engineering operation folks all on the same page before we move fully out of architecture and into full build or design phase. We also make sure then we've got the service defined for build. So one of the key things we do is make sure that we have a project manager defined. So to carry that through, so to get us into that build and transition phase, so we have an actual project manager getting us and driving us into operations. The other big thing, and I think a lot of you probably understand this, is a lot of people, when someone comes up with an idea for a service, they say, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's go ahead and get that. Let's go ahead and do that. But once we get through the architecture phase and we have a pretty good idea of what that's going to look like, the big funding thing comes up. So we've even put a checkbox in there to make sure we've got funding secured in order to carry on. So we're doing everything possible to make sure that this becomes a success when it goes into operations. As you go through the build process, you can see we have a lot of things that you'll see in an ITIL organization, right? Who are your affected users, your availability target, communication plans, engineering requirements, cost, what region it's going to be used by, who the BU is, any exceptions that you might have, external service cost, hours of operation. This is all data that we're collecting and going to use as part of servicing this service. You can see then we start getting into the incident side, right? So making sure that our service desk and our support personnel really, really have everything they need to be successful, right? We just don't want to build something and then hand it off to the users and say we're done. We're making sure that we can fully support it. In a company like us, we have to make sure we can fully support it across the globe. So it's very important to have all of these details before you go operational with that service. So again, you can see, you know, incidents, known errors, KPIs, metrics. Again, you can see all of these are documents that we create and we'll put in our knowledge base, and they will be easily accessible. And if they're not in the knowledge base, we do not go to the next gate. So it's ensuring we have all that before we go operational. Again, we can have power users. You know, if we want to be able to see it, you know, if we think we're having an issue, we might want to go to our power users and say, hey, are you seeing a problem? So we have those identified. We've got relationships to our assets in the CMDB if the service has that type of relationship requirement. And then we get into our resolution routing and detail. We even got risk management sign off in here, right? Disaster recovery for the service, security for the service, and even data privacy. We get into data privacy issues, so we've got all that covered with risk management sign off. We start thinking about our rollout and rollback plans, our service catalog. How are we gonna advertise and get this? You know, get this service out into our service catalog, and then the actual service requests, and then the routes for those. All of that gets created here as you're building that service out. We've got, you know, as you can see, this is a long list. So a lot of people don't realize what really goes into delivering a service. Right? Here's your service level agreements, your service level objectives. All your support material, your support availability, your charging mechanism, right? Are you going to do internal chargeback for this? Or are these bills coming directly from a vendor, right? So all of those thoughts, training plan, right? Do we have external tools or knowledge, right? So we even got a spot for the link there. And then it is a certain, maybe the service is only for IT, right? So we're going to control who we actually advertise this service to. So that is just in the build phase. And then you can see in gate 6, we've got our traditional testing and QA gate to make sure we've got that completed and approved. And then we get into the change control. Right? So the idea is that your service manager then becomes responsible for getting it implemented and changed, not the same person or the same persons who've been building all this. Your service manager has to be the one to accept it and say, yes, this is good, yes, it's in production. So you can see he's got a release checklist and he's got a post-rollout verification checklist. right? So the idea is that you make the change, you validate everything's working, you validate your everything's in the catalog, your service offerings are out there, right? And then you go in and complete the change, and now you're full operations. So this is really bringing together all the groups within your IT organization that gets you from that idea and gets you operational with that new or changed service.
All right.
So I think cool. Nate's going to go through the next part of the demo.
Thanks, Clark.
Yep.
All right. So what I'm going to be going through is... I'm on six. What I'm going to be going through is the self-service portal. So for Johnson Controls, we built up a comprehensive self-service portal in SharePoint. And the rationale behind this is that Johnson Controls contains many, many users with many different languages. So we need to support a lot of different experiences, a lot of ways to get at data, and a lot of ways to see data. So you'll notice at the top we started with a search-centric experience. The reason we did that is because in order to find information in these sort of vast knowledge bases, you're not going to necessarily browse to that information. You're going to be looking to search for that information. So we're focusing on a search-centric experience because that provides us the ability to serve our user the fastest possible way. We're also facilitating a browsing-centric experience. So down here you can see we've got different tier one business services listed for Johnson Controls. On the upper right-hand corner, this allows us to use machine translation to translate anything on the page. So if I need to translate this into German, which might be a person's initial language that they need to see this content in, we can actually translate all of our page content into a language that aligns with that visitor. The machine translation is appropriate for basic understanding of content. When you see the knowledge base, what you'll see is that we do allow for the facilitation of knowledge content in a native language and filtering based upon that native language. Sometimes machine translation isn't appropriate, such as a policy document, for example. A policy document needs to be very specific because you're putting that in place for their own regulations. So in a policy document, you're not going to use machine translation. You're going to have a human translate it. We're also surfacing service advisories. So video conferencing quality or password change delays, their service advisory allow us to be able to delay or at least tell users about things that are happening in the system. And then we're also surfacing open service requests and incidents that a person may have. So in the virtual knowledge agent, what we do, it gives us the ability to search. So I'm going to search on, say, mobility. And what that's going to do is bring up a virtual knowledge agent page. And on the left-hand side, you can see that we're allowing for filtering. So for example, if you're using smartphones, you might want to filter that down to something more specific. The idea behind it is just like when you go out to buy a TV at a ordering site, you're going to want to be able to filter down the requests that you're interested in. We're surfacing knowledge snippets, like ordering a new phone. So we'll say, OK, here's information about ordering a new phone that you might want to follow. Or we might send them into a presentation or a Word document. This is all coming from a SharePoint knowledge base. So this isn't something that requires a lot of it's not technically challenging to put this together. It's something that's more about a process challenge, saying putting these different elements of SharePoint content together to represent it in search experience. The cool thing about this is it's available everywhere. So if I wanted to make the search experience available on another page through native SharePoint search, I totally can. I also facilitate the ability for someone to actually place an order through the self-service portal. So this can surface those questions from service manager's request offering and allows me then to interact with that request through Office 365. So as a user comes out, they can type in the answers to the things that we're surfacing tied to that service request right within the search experience. We're also surfacing the translate button here too. So the translate button then is facilitating our user experience. And we're allowing them, if they got here and something's broken, we're not making them go back out. We're allowing them to continue. So we have this Need Help button. And the Need Help button surfaces information about how to get in touch with the service desk. So if I need to use phone support, I can actually do that and get that information right through this interface, as well as dive into opening up a generic help request. So this facilitates really a full user experience from searching for knowledge, but not forcing them, right? So we're not forcing them to go through this step and that step. People hate being forced into things. But I'm facilitating this sort of searching experience without them being forced into the searching experience. So it becomes very intuitive. OK. So the next experience that that I'll walk through here as a browsing experience. So let's say that I'm interested, not in like, I don't have something broken, I don't have anything that's really wrong, but I'm interested in understanding the services that IT offers to the business. So underneath communication services, I can see I have mobility services. And what I can see is I have the tier three services, so smartphones, the example that Clark was using is available there, or I might go to the tier two service. And if I go to the tier two service, what's gonna happen is it's gonna bring up the tier two services page, which talks about the tier three services, what the service actually is, some related policy content. We're not, this content is surfaced based upon SharePoint metadata. So the SharePoint metadata tells the system what it is that it's gonna surface on a particular page. And all Office 365 based systems are allowing, could do this, as well as an on-premise SharePoint implementation. Your related service categories are also there. These are the other tier two services. And then interior to one of these, we're surfacing information about the tier three service and allowing you to move into that tier three service from this page. So now I'm looking now at smartphone content. We're surfacing a picture, the things you can do with smartphones, policies, training, knowledge information, frequently asked questions, as well as the ability to get support. So I can actually dive right back into that search experience from the same page. The idea behind doing this is, it, again, provides that opportunity for the user to go down a path and then not have to go back up a path to get support. They can always continue down the path that we're leading them and get the kind of support that they're expecting from this experience. So I can go straight into the order a new phone request, or I can open up frequently asked question content from here. Okay. The next experience I'm going to show you, let's see, you're on number
three,
is our business intelligence experience. Okay, so right here what we're using, now think about it this way, the self-service portal experience is more for an end user. This is going to be more for your IT analysts, your directors, your decision makers, people needing to use content in the system. One of the experiences that I found are really useful is making sure that we're serving the back end of the tool. It's like if you had a sales management tool and your sales guys were putting in upcoming opportunities into this tool, but they never had an opportunity to be able to see how they were doing. They didn't see their trending, they didn't know what sales opportunities were coming in, your management had no idea what was coming in. If you didn't provide that second half of the picture, you're gonna see the system as a failure. In our case, what we're doing is we're focusing on making sure we provide that second half of the picture. So we're using a technology called Microsoft PowerView and Power BI. PowerView allows us to surface data from Service Manager using a tabular model. And you can see the same kind of service definition, right? So this is communication services. And underneath communication services, I can see all the open incidents associated with this, as well as the CTI, which is our category, and the status, and the created date associated with that incident. We also allow for click-through type experiences, so I can click through into the actual incident itself, and it will bring up that incident within the web console. So it allows for that to come out here. There we go. And if I double-click on this, it allows for me to dig into the next tier. So I double-click on communication services, now I'm at the tier two of communication services, which contains conferencing, mobility, and video services. I double-click on that, it drives me into my smartphone service, and when I select it, what you'll notice is that it allows for me then to filter down these services below, which is very useful. On the right-hand side of the chart, I can also break down different types of components of this, and it provides me with totals. So you can see that between incidents and service requests, I have about 20,000 active work items right now. Same kind of situation exists with my service resolve metrics. So for example, if I selected communication services, this allows me to say, how am I doing from the standpoint of on-time resolution? How am I doing from the standpoint of my services that are on time at delivering the TTO? Or how many of my services have active work items in them? Same kind of experience with my open work items. So if I'm an analyst and I want to be able to have a dashboard that provides me a touch-centric experience, this is what we've created. So it allows me to see all the open major incidents that exist in the system that impact my teams. So I can do click through into that. And then I also am surfacing the difference between incidents and service requests. Notice I actually filter down here when I select one of these top buttons. I see all of my teams not assigned active work items, and I'm indicating whether or not a particular work item is meeting its objectives or not meeting its objectives. So what I'm doing here is I'm taking everything from the highest possible level of incidents and service requests down to actionable items. And that's a core aspect of delivering good business intelligence, is allowing someone to make the kind of decision they need to make based upon the scorecard you're using. Work through a use case that aligns with what it is that they want to see. A couple other useful things. Right now, Johns Controls is going through an SCCM upgrade pattern. So what we've done is we've surfaced configuration management database data to show us where the upgraded systems are and where the upgraded systems are not. So it allows us to be able to use map-centric data from the CMDB to be able to map out that content around the globe. Very, very useful, because it allows us to be able to understand at a moment's notice where configuration item data lives and how we can serve that configuration item data. We're also servicing system metrics, and system metrics allow for us to be able to get important information about the numbers of work items flowing through the system. This is more for your admins, your kind of back-end items. Someone who wants to say, you know, how many active incidents are running in the system, how many closed work items, allows us to then get to metrics based upon support groups, allows us to surface information about work items created over a period of time. We can do resolve work items over a period of time. You can see here we're comparing against 2014 and 2013. We can surface KPIs and survey results. One of the things that we found really useful, this is an example of survey results, is we want to survey and give the opportunity for anybody to provide feedback. So for example, let's say that I was in this session, I said, okay, everybody who has really good feedback, go and fill out a survey evaluation, right? But everybody who doesn't have good feedback, please don't do it. Like, that's kind of what service desks sometimes do, right? They specifically send surveys to people who they think are going to give them positive feedback. Well, in our case, we allow everybody to do that. So then we can surface that information based upon teams and based upon certain metrics. So were they courteous and professional? Were they responding on time? We can start to surface data that's going to be useful for those people. So I'll walk through how we went about delivering on this. And if you have questions after, we can actually go into more detail about it. All right. So let's go through some implementation details. So in our topology, one of the things that we did that made us very successful is we segmented all the roles. So you can see that we have a segmentation of our service manager connection servers, our orchestrator management servers, and our runbook servers, as well as the orchestrator servers that run batch processes. We've isolated those servers because it allows for us to isolate which work patterns need to respond at different intervals. So for example, we have some batch processes that bring in hundreds of thousands of items overnight. Well, that hundred thousands of items, we don't want to impact the normal work pattern of the overnight users. So we've allowed ourselves to segment that based upon segmenting the individual orchestrator pods that we have. We also use an always-on availability group for SQL. So we actually have virtual SQL servers for this very large environment, and these virtual SQL servers replicate between each other using an always-on availability group, and that always-on availability group also provides us the opportunity to use a read-only secondary, and I'll show you why we leverage that. A couple tips on scalability. Obviously, this is a pretty significant, highly scaled environment, and we needed to master how we go about scaling Service Manager. So we went through a lot of various bumps in the road to be able to get there, but we were able to accomplish achieving very high scalability, and we actually have some great testing numbers to show it. I could do a whole presentation on that topic. So if you want to learn about scalability in Service Manager, watch the MMS presentation I gave last year on System Center Service Manager scalability, and that'll give you a lot of detailed content on that. Some things that I think were very instrumental in our success was using web consoles for end users. We are just recently applying SCSM 2012 R2 UR2, which is addressing various bugs that exist in the console maximization. Power View and Power BI, this is a very important aspect of our infrastructure. We have a combination of the CMDB, an analysis services tabular model, and PowerView itself. We're using always on secondary to read from the CMDB data. Now, if you're a company that has, say, 10,000 users or less, there's really no reason to be doing an always on secondary. You could easily be reading from your production CMDB using the tabular model that we're talking about. In a large environment like this, we didn't want our reads against our production CMDB, so we use the always on secondary, which allows us to read from a copy of the database which isn't being used by the system. All right. So here's what the model for Service Manager plus Power View looks like. So on the left-hand side, what you can see here is we have our configuration management database and our data warehouse. We're reading to an analysis services server, which is running in tabular mode. It pulls it into the tabular model itself on a 5-minute interval. So every 5 minutes, it's updating this tabular model. And it's using that 5-minute interval to provide us with the freshest possible data. So those scorecards you saw are actually updated every 5 minutes. That's drastically faster than using the analysis services cubes that rely upon data warehouse sync and then analysis services cube processing. This allows us to surface that data very, very quickly and allows us to present business intelligence data, which is happening now as opposed to happening like 6 hours ago. This is surfaced through one of two places, SharePoint 2013 on-premise, which is where PowerView lives, or Power BI, which lives in Office 365. So the example I was showing was using PowerView. You can use one of those two examples and get very good results. All right. For portal options, we chose, as you could probably see, to go with a branded, more heavily customized SharePoint environment that facilitated the searching experience that we were looking for. For a global environment that had as significant of a customer experience that we needed to provide on, this totally aligned with our needs. However, if your needs were a little bit simpler, you could do a couple other things. You could use a third-party out-of-box portal with a simple SharePoint front end. You could use synchronized SharePoint list or libraries, or you could use the out-of-box portal. So there's a variety of different options that you could be using here. All right. Load testing. When we went through our load testing process, we found that we used a couple of really key tools that allowed us to get the right user experience. One of the load testing tools that we used was Visual Studio Load Testing Suite. So in Visual Studio, you can create your own synthetic tests against the system. It allows us to record those tests and then run those tests from a variety of different endpoints. This we used for our sort of pre-testing patterns because it allowed us to be able to run, say, simulate 40 users hitting the system at the same time and giving us the experience that they receive. And then tell me where in that process it slows down so we can provide the right feedback. We define the expected response times, and then right below here in the slide deck, you can find the link to that. It's actually really easy if you bing it, but I put the link there anyway. So it allows you to find how to actually set that up. For work item processing behind the scenes, for SLT application and so on, we also need to make sure that when we were loading the system up with millions of incidents, we weren't slowing everything down. So we had a very engineered process we went through to validate our work item processing. Work item processing would be things like, I create a new incident, and within a minute, I need a notification. Or within a minute, I need this routed to the right person. Or I want to see this provide an SLT update in the right time frame. Because if you have an application that takes down a facility, I can't have my notification around the service level target come 20 minutes later. It's not going to allow us to service them well. It has to be something that happens quickly. So let's walk through load testing. When we load tested, we broke it up into 5 different pieces. This first piece was really about establishing what we're doing now. So the Remedy system was running about 2 million incidents a year, maybe slightly less than that. We had data around 18 months worth of created data. We found we didn't have any updated data. So like we didn't know how often incidents were updated. We knew they got created, but didn't know how often they were updated. So we actually had to go and turn on some logging in the system to get that data. So we only had 2 months worth of data for that. We had an idea of concurrent console users, but the problem with Remedy is people would open up Remedy, minimize it, and then they leave it open all day. So it provided us with some problems in terms of getting information that was useful to us. All right, so what we did is we said, all right, how many average cases are we creating per hour? And what we saw here is that we had on average about 15 incidents or cases created per hour. On one day, we had a little bit of a sort of non-standard sort of set. So that accounted for that. But on average, we were under 15. Updates, on the other hand, were about 45 per hour on average. Note, this is just average, right? So you're going to see spikes in this space. When you combine them together, we had about 50 combined created or updated cases per hour on average. This is what we're going to see typically. This is our normal load. Now, you can't just take normal load as a mechanism to go about building a system. Because if it's Monday morning and everybody's stuff is broken, you don't want your ticketing system to fail, right? So what we did is we also looked at maximum. So maximum accounted for over 100 created per minute. It also accounted for over 160 updates per minute. Now, some of these can be floods from monitoring tools, but it's still legitimate things we needed to check. So we then took this data and we did load testing against it. So load testing was really interesting. After we went through all of our tuning, what we did in our orchestrated runbooks is we actually made sure that the runbooks actually tested for the expected load. And also, if they weren't performing properly, what they would do is they would pause. So they wouldn't bring in additional load if the system wasn't performing properly. And then we compared that against our best practices that we defined. So what this looked like is we did a load test of about 45,000 work items over the course of 52 minutes. And what we saw is that we were able to achieve about 900 work items a minute in the system. Now, you'll see these kind of dips and valleys, and that's as a result of the system actually adapting to performance needs. Very easy to put in, actually. There's a lot of ways to test the system. The goal of this was to make sure that it would perform well when we turned it on. So in a 10-minute sample, what you can see is that we had a period where it actually waits because the system isn't performing as it needs to. What we experienced, actually, was we were able to do those 900 a minute with no performance impact on the system once we defined it. That's pretty cool, right? Like 900 a minute without any performance impact. That's because we went and tested for it, and we built the architecture properly. So what this really shows is that Service Manager, when tuned appropriately, actually scales well. You just need to know what you're doing with it, and you need to scale it properly so you're not doing things that are going to negatively impact overall system performance. All right. Before going into production, one of the things we wanted to do is do user acceptance testing. User acceptance testing allows for us to validate that the system is going to meet the requirements that we defined. So as we went through direct design, we actually went through the creation of three different types of documents. The functional requirements that say, the system must do this. Then the functional specification, which defines, based upon the system needing to do this, here's how I'm actually going to implement it in the system. That implementing it in the system metric allows us to map to a requirement that we have. And then the use case allows us to hand off that testing process to a user who's going to say, okay, I'm going to go into the user interface, and I'm going to do this, 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 and this, and it's going to do what I expect it to do. So the combination of these three things allows you to validate a system. When you take this approach, it allows for your user experience to be able to match what it is that you're expecting them to get, rather than just have kind of like, oh, my user ran into this error, I'm going to fix it. My user ran into this error, I'm going to fix it. When you're building a system that's used by thousands of analysts, this provides an opportunity for us to validate if they get the experience that we want them to have. All right, so I'm going to show you a brief example of what those look like. Okay. And this isn't rocket science here. This is kind of a simple thing. So what you have in Agile is you have something called a story ID. And a story ID maps to a story name. So for example, story ID S001 maps to incident closure story. It's an automation, which means it's not a person doing it. It's something that happens behind the scenes. You say your goal. So you say, I can close incidents after they have been resolved for 7 days, based upon an automation. It has a series of steps. In this particular case, it has only one step, so it's a very practical, simple type of experience. So you say, when an incident has been resolve status for 7 days, then change it to the close status. Just defining this allows us to say, here's how we expect the system to work, right? You define this ahead of time. What ends up happening is nobody's coming back to you and saying, this isn't how I wanted it, because we defined it ahead of time. Now, someone might say that our functional requirement's wrong, But that's why you get sign-off on functional requirements before you go and build. So this allows us to take a very engineered approach. Or something like incident status changes changes the status of an incident at certain points in its life. Submit an incident, it goes to active. Route an incident so it's assigned to a support group, active goes to assigned. Assign an incident to a specific person, active goes to work in progress. So it allows us to map down through those processes to allow us to document the things that we're actually doing. Same thing with notifications, right? Define out how you want the notification to work before you actually build it. We then map that to the actual use case itself. So we say user navigates to the web console, then the user is able to access Johnson Controls website and my work item screen is displayed. It can be very practical, right? They don't have to be super complex, but it allows us to be able to get the kind of impact that we want. All right, onboarding. So one of the things that we found really necessary during the onboarding process is the definition of an operational matrix. The operational matrix says, here's what we need to do to be successful once this goes into operations. And that's part of the gating process, right? It's like, do you have what's necessary to actually execute? So you have a responsibility, you have an assigned engineer or a process resource, and then what we've been doing is organizing something called a center of excellence, and the job of the center of excellence is to have these operational responsibilities. So let me show you an example of what that looks like. So what we've done is we've actually mapped all the individual responsibilities. So application platform, service manager configuration, orchestrator configuration, web console architecture, and so on. And we've mapped these either to operational roles, and we've mapped them to different change windows, and then to skills that are required for those change windows. And the reason why we did that is because it allows us to be very specific about the kind of skills a particular person needs to have to support a system. This is something that you can do for any system that you deploy. So you deploy and say, here's the things you need to do to be able to support this when it goes into production. And then you can actually work towards skills. What we found is that when we're really generic, it's actually really hard to get people to become the purple squirrel that a service manager engineer is, right? It's very difficult to get to that kind of skill set. When we're very specific, it allows us to assign specific responsibilities. You'll notice that we also broke down, I'll show you an example here, a breakdown between deployment and development. The idea behind that, breaking down between deployment and development, is you might be very able to take a developed runbook and deploy it into production. You might not be as able to be able to develop the runbook from scratch. So there's different people doing different jobs. Once you figure out what kind of skills a person has, you can kind of put them in certain buckets. Then you can let them grow their skill set to be at a particular spot. And that's very helpful, I think, for training. Internal marketing and training. What we did is, this is actually kind of cool. We had an external marketing company come in, and they produced an internal marketing video to sell the overall deployment. When you've got, let's say you've got 50 IT people, maybe you don't need an internal marketing video. When you've got thousands of IT people, you kind of might need something like this. So what we did is we produced this internal marketing video that we then provided out on through these IT summits, and then also provided out, we're going to provide out through the Office 365 page. That allows for people to experience what's coming and get the message of what we're doing. Also, it allowed us to walk through the project process, and we also socialized the project with the groups that are getting converted. Onboarding process looked like this. Now, some conversions that we do are big bangs. They are, I'm going to take this system, and I'm going to fully replace it with another system tomorrow. That kind of process is great for, you know, a smaller organization. In our case, what we did is we found we weren't going to be able to reshape the process and replace the system all at once. And the idea behind this is what we did is we actually did an integration with Remedy where we synchronized all the work items from Remedy into Service Manager. And then we were able to convert groups in a chunk. Now, it still allows you to move as fast as possible, but allowed us to be able to do the kind of conversion that was necessary. Now, a lot of organizations, you can easily do big bangs. It depends on the business and what it is that they want to accomplish. During the process of conversion, we actually normalize the services that an organizational entity had, say network computing or end user computing and so on. We articulated their services in that service catalog. We defined the services. And then we normalized their routing process, which is the classification, CTI. We normalized their support groups. So, for example, we had over 30,000 classifications. Your classification list with 30,000 items. So we normalized that to be able to significantly reduce the number of classifications that we had. We had tens of thousands of support groups, so we significantly reduced that. And then also we're updating all the routes, because a lot of the routes didn't go to the right people. System's only as good as the data that's in it, right? So one of the key tenets was fix the process, fix the data, you end up with a system that's much more usable. In our onboarding data normalization, we built the user content. So we built the connector to the provisioning system, which is a FIM-based system, as well as Active Directory. We cleaned up the user information as it was brought in. And then as we onboarded groups, we created request offerings for their requests. So the request offerings themselves were broken into kind of three different senses, right? We have basic request offerings, workflow-based request offerings, and automations. A basic request offering would be what we figured on doing an onboarding. A basic request offering would be, give me the questions you need, and then we'll onboard your questions. Another type of request offering was one that included workflow content, and the workflow content would be something like, when you submit this smartphone request, we want it to do this. So that's very useful because it allows us to be able to map out the process that an individual user is going to follow when they come through the system. If we didn't have the workflow, then we weren't able to be able to help them to normalize how their processes flow through their organization. We didn't have the time during onboarding. We don't have the time during onboarding to be able to do that for every single request offering. Your scope's too big. But it allows us to expand it as we go. Automation is really the target that we want everybody to be able to get to. So automation is where we kind of started the project. Clark was talking about how we did the workstation automation and the application automation and asset automation. And that automation process allows you to save a lot of time. If you've gone to any of Jeffrey Snover's PowerShell talks, one of the things that he kind of talks about is this idea that PowerShell allows us to be able to get time back. It allows us to have substantial ROI. It allows us to standardize our infrastructures. Automation is really what we're going after there. But if you don't have a clean process, then automation becomes really, really challenging. So we started with just basic request offerings. For internal marketing and training, what we did was we have recorded training, we're doing user guides, and doing in-person training with groups. That kind of process allows for us to be able to convey to an individual group when they get onboarded what exactly that looks like for them. That training process is really practical because for some people, you can walk through the user experience in a group. For other people, you might not be able to do that, right? They might be somewhere else in the world, and it allows for them to be able to experience that differently. All right, go live, team by team. We started with global infrastructure teams. We're moving into the enterprise organization and also into business units. And from a follow-up standpoint, we're looking forward to doing an internal marketing after individual teams have been experiencing the system for a while. So the goal behind that is we convert a group, let's use them for forward marketing internal to the system that allows us to be able to show them the experience that we were using as an organization. So the team gets converted, we want them to have a positive experience, we want to use Agile to get their feedback, and then we can feed that into groups that are going to be converted so we can get their experience that they're looking to have. So we can say, hey, this was really good for me, looking forward to you getting converted as well. That kind of forward marketing is very useful for us as an organization. Also, we have something called a backlog. Anybody use backlogs in your organization, like Agile backlogs? Yeah? Okay. So this is critical to a conversion project, okay? So if you have a large service manager or even a non-service manager project you're doing, backlogs facilitate you taking feedback and accepting feedback, but accepting feedback into a list that allows for you to say, okay, great, thank you for that feedback. I'd like it to be blue. Well, like, great. We had a gentleman who asked for different coloring or sorting of the work items in the dropdown. Well, that's good feedback, right? You want to get that kind of feedback. But it might not be a critical deliverable, and it might not be something that we even want to do. So the backlog allows us to take those items, put them onto the backlog, and determine which of them we're going to address at what times. It allows us to be very specific. It also allows us to phase out what it is that we're delivering. And when you phase out what you're delivering, it allows you to be much more successful because people know that you're going to get something, but they might not get it right away. And that allows them to have the kind of experience that they're looking for. All right, What is next? So what's next is we're going to continue the onboarding process. Now, continuing the onboarding process means we're going to be converting more teams. We're going to bring them into the tool. We're going to be doing an integration into the architecture tool. So we have another tool that we use for actually building out architectures that we're going to apply to different systems. So as you went through that gating process, we're basically mapping out the architectures that we had against something that we defined ahead of time. So you say, like, for example, if I'm going to deploy a new web application, where should it live? If I'm going to deploy a new file collaboration environment, should it be Dropbox or should it be OneDrive? You know, what experience should I be using in my organization? So we're mapping that into the architecture tool. So as an architecture gets defined, that can then become available to us when we're going through our gating process. Also, we're going to be mapping into Operations Manager. Right now, there's a usage of HP OpenView. So we're receiving that through our Remedy integration. So OpenView requests come through, and we get it through the Remedy integration. What we're doing is we're deploying Operations Manager, and we're going to be intaking alerts from Ops Manager into the service process. Right now, a lot of those alerts are not useful. They're not actionable. They come through in thousands, and then you just go and disable them. What we're doing is we're going to be changing those to be based upon teams and application architectures and sending them to the right teams directly. We're also going to have to replace existing external integrations. One of the things you experience in large organizations like this is you have these external sort of e-bonding sort of scenarios. Who's doing kind of an e-bonding scenario with your external, like, help desk providers? Not a whole lot of you? Okay. So in this case, what we're doing is there's certain external organizations that actually run some of the incidents, and those external organizations are responsible for responding to those incidents. So we have an external sort of e-bonding scenario with them. We have to replace those because they come through Remedy, and we can switch that over into the service manager environment. All right. So what I've done is I've left a little bit of time here for some questions. So we can take your questions as a group. Certainly visit our recently launched community site, itilforitpros.com, and also go and check us out on Twitter and so on. Join us on the link up. There's a created link up front by Christian Booth. Every month we meet, it's growing and growing and growing. So it's getting bigger and bigger. Definitely join the link up if you want to get information about how you can be successful with this. We'll be around after this to be able to do demos. We've got about 10-ish minutes here to do some question and answer, either for me or for Clark. And let's thank you for coming around. So first question.
Question for Nate. I see the interface you used here is a custom SharePoint interface.
Correct.
Is that right? One of the new things that came up is the availability of service manager through the Azure Pack by Great Pro. So is that something you're looking into? Is that something you advise new implementations to consider?
So yes, we're definitely looking at that. Clark, do you want to address that as part of business hosting?
Sure. That's definitely something that we're looking to address. I mean, we didn't really talk about it here, but I mean, we have a huge business hosting infrastructure, and to really try and make that portal a much better experience and much easier to build and maintain is something that we're definitely looking to do. So, you know, it's definitely on our roadmap and on our radar to look at that and see how we could integrate it into this, into our service catalog and be, in a sense, a punch out, I think is what we're thinking. But yeah, absolutely.
So with the sheer quantity of service requests that could be published to this portal, at what point did you guys feel it was sort of ready to introduce to the general public to sort of gather the most widespread adoption?
Well, that's a good question. So in order to kind of shape it for the end user experience, you have to determine what it is that you're willing to publish out, right? So we started with global infrastructure, and global infrastructure is sort of a sub-part of the overall organization, and you've got all these business units that are sort of their own entities in a way. They kind of run in their own sort of silo, and then they interact with global infrastructure. So felt that one of the things that was actually given down by the overall organization is to go out and define services across the business. We're not going to have request offerings when all that gets done, right? We're doing that on onboarding. So figure that the global infrastructure requests are actually probably enough for us to go live. From a user experience point of view, one of the things that we had to do is when you have global users, you have to use something called audiences in SharePoint to be able to tailor back the user experience that they're leveraging. So the audiences allow us to say, if I'm searching for cell phones here, give them this experience. If I'm searching for cell phones here, give them this experience. Because if I'm in Germany, my cell phone order is going to be different than it is in the United States. So we had to tailor that appropriately. So we have maybe a couple request offerings that are then filtered back based upon the audience. We also have security settings. So the security settings allow us to say, you should never, ever, ever be able to do a server request because you're Joe user in the business. You have no right doing a server request. So the combination of security and request offerings allow for us to deliver an experience that fits the user base, as well as the translate capability. All right, what other kinds of questions you guys have?
Go for it. Hello. I just would be interested in, can you tell us some data, also, how long the whole project was, how many people were involved with? Because everything we saw today, I think it was a larger enterprise.
Yeah, that's a good question. Service manager's been in place at Johnson Controls, what is it, 1.5 years probably?
Yeah, 1.5, 2 years, I think.
The first initiative actually was really fast. We needed to push out this workstation ordering application deployment stuff within a couple months. So think about that. Like, you start a service manager project and you need to be automating workstation deployment across the globe in like 2 or 3 months. That's pretty crazy, right? So like, and then they had to go and do what was the 70,000 replacements or something. So the first part of this project was really fast because it was really technically oriented. I think there was probably some flaws in that we were so focused on technology, we maybe missed some of the process elements of that because we were just focused on getting it out the door. And that's sometimes how some technology deliverables are, right? You're just so focused on getting out the door, you miss the broken process element of it. So then you end up having to come back and fix it. We were very interested in making sure we didn't have to do that with IT service management. So that's why we started with directed design. So we went through at least 3 months of just process design work, and then we went into the actual technical implementation. So you're looking at a good year and a half of different types of effort. Now, if you've got 50 IP people and 10,000 users, your project's going to look different, right? But when you're trying to serve a global community like this, you have a little bit of different character of the project that you're going through, plus a lot of existing integrations that you need to be able to serve or at least understand how they're going to work. One of the biggest challenges we had was that Remedy had at least 300 fields on their form. Like, you open up Remedy on the incident form, you've got 300 fields. Most of those fields were not actually useful. But we had to go against this kind of idea that it doesn't look like Remedy anymore. What are we going to do, right? So there's a lot of re-education that's necessary to be able to show them why less fields is actually better. So we want to make our incident process as easy as selecting a classification and it getting to the right person. What other questions do you folks have?
It's actually a question on content that you displayed.
Sure.
Some of the tabular data that you were showing us, do you actually have anything maybe on a blog that shows examples on how you built some of those?
Yeah, I love that question. So there is not a blog yet on creating tabular data. I intend to create one. So you'll probably see that within the next like week or so. And I'll put it out on the service manager, Twitter tag. There are blogs on using Power BI, setting up Power View, but the relationship between all those pieces together and kind of an easy walkthrough isn't out there right now. So we're going to definitely be creating that. What other questions do you folks have?
A lot of this stuff is about people and processes and less about technology.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you go about getting the sponsorship for the upper management to do a project like this? Because it's not the same as you are inventing a new product that you're going to sell. It's more internal mechanisms within the organization you have to change, the whole way you operate on a daily basis. So how did you get that sponsorship?
Sure thing. Clark, do you want to take that?
Sure. Like I mentioned early on, it was really about the success we had in transforming our PC deployment and our application deployment within our PCs, right? We showed leadership the value of that, right? And then that led to, hey, we really need to do something about Remedy. They then felt, hey, you guys did all this on Service Manager with in a sense the service request for PCs. We'll give you some runway now to start moving Remedy off of that, right? So as we dug into it, and as we communicated our issues around process, right, we really wanted to drive and say, hey, look, we've got process issues. You really need to address the process issues and get those defined in order to have success when you go out and build your ITSM systems, right? So I think, you know, there's a lot of education. Yeah, we get pushback. You know, what's the value? You know, why is it taking so long? Or why do I need to do process? But I think when they see the capabilities and what you're able to do, some of the Agile stuff, you know, when we started doing some of the Agile development and showing that to the leadership, they really started buying in, right? So it's kind of an evolution. And so you really need to decide, you know, where to start and then making sure you're showing success as you go forward. That's exactly probably why we were able to, or why we're on this journey. We're showing success, and every step we take is more and more success.
All right, what other questions are there? Go for it.
Actually, I had another silly, just tech one. Some of the custom work that you've done, not necessarily the Service Manager portal, sure. Were you just doing raw deep link queries in to like pull some of that incident data out? Like, how'd you go about doing that?
Yeah, good question. What we actually have is we leveraged Azure Cache to be able to surface that information. Yeah, so we grabbed it from Service Manager database, put it in Azure Cache, and then surfaced it as a page viewer web part in SharePoint. Simpler deployments could use just a list synchronization process, and that's really, I mean, you can have that up in like an afternoon, basically. It's not as robust, obviously, but it can do a lot of the same things. The user interface from a search standpoint is really just SharePoint search. So it's a SharePoint search that got some, you know, if you have a SharePoint kind of dev guy, right, he can do that customization to style it the way you want. It's allowing you to search the request offerings, which is living in a list, the knowledge-based articles, which also lives in a list, and then the frequently asked question content, which is in the knowledge article database as well. So really, that's just a SharePoint search interface that's been customized a little bit. The browsable interface, I mean, everybody can kind of do that. So what other questions?
Hi, I wanted to ask a question about the users that were being affected by all this change, specifically the end users, but I'm also including the IT people as well.
Yeah.
Who was your happiest user or your happiest group of users when this went into effect, and who was the group that didn't like it the most?
That's a good question. I think the experience you could probably share is mostly from the workstation ordering experience. People who are probably, maybe you can deal with that one, Clark.
Yeah. I think, you know, our IT support saw that we were taking some control away. So, I mean, they were pushing back initially. But once they saw the integration and the standardization and the ability to continue to do their job, I think they are much, much happier now. It took a while for them to accept that you know, we want everything to go through a service request, and we want to track that so we have all the business intelligence around it, everything that goes with that. And I think, you know, it's hard for us sometimes to get that end user feedback, but I think, you know, they're starting to really, you know, really enjoy the fact that we can streamline the request process, we can standardize it so that the outcomes are now predictable, right? Many times people get frustrated because they request something and they don't hear back, they don't get it fulfilled in the time that we say. So as we start meeting those objectives, right, the end users become more and more happy, the support teams become more and more happy, and our engineering teams can spend more time on building the next things rather than supporting all the issues going on in the environment. So that's kind of where we're trying to head.
All right, guys. Well, it's been a blessing talking to you today. We'll be around a little bit afterward, reach the end of our available time. But we'll be around, and we'll certainly answer your questions as you want to bring them up. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks.